The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Can you hear me well? Even back there? Okay, great. So good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be back here on Monday. I'm usually here on Tuesdays, teaching Dharma in Spanish. I chose a topic today that is not talked about a lot in the Buddhist circles. It's boundaries. If we have any psychologist here, you know that this is a topic that is very central to your field. But I want to take this topic and bring it into the context of Buddhism and see if we can discover how do we hold this subject of boundaries within the context of the teachings of the Buddha. I want to start with a quote. There was a wall. It did not look important. It was built of uncut rocks, roughly mortared. An adult could look right over it, and even a child could climb it. Where it crossed the road, instead of having a gate, it had generated into mere geometry, a line, an idea of a boundary. But the idea was real. It was important. Like all walls, it was ambiguous, two-faced. What was inside it and what was outside it depended upon which side of it you were on. So this is Ursula Le Guin. And I want to use this evocative description of Le Guin to delve into the topic of boundaries. And I have set myself the task of answering three questions. The first one, what are personal boundaries? The second one, how does the concept of personal boundaries relate to the Buddhist teachings, especially of the teaching of no self or anatta? And the third one, how does this practice help us clarify, strengthen, and uphold our boundaries in our daily life? So at its very basic, we can say that boundaries are signs in space. It can be a wall, a fence, a sign communicating the beginning and ending of a territory, of a property. We help ourselves to describe something that is personal and abstract, such as personal boundaries with something that is very impersonal and concrete, such as land boundaries. The term boundary, of course, is borrowed from real estate. So how do signs in space relate to our personal boundaries? We communicate signs in space constantly by the way we present ourselves, the way we dress, the way we move, the gestures we make, the language we use. So we communicate and teach others what we allow, what we don't allow, what we want to reinforce, and in general, how do we want to be treated? Now, ideally, these signs in space that we communicate messages of integrity about ourselves. I like this term, integrity, especially within the Buddhist context, because it not only implies virtue or sila, but also honesty, goodness, trustworthiness, right-mindedness, but also, and maybe most importantly, wholeness. Therefore, if we are communicating messages of integrity, we're being able to perceive ourselves as a whole and present ourselves as a whole to the world. And that includes all of us, including our weaknesses too. So when we are communicating ourselves or presenting ourselves through boundaries, we are communicating strong and clear awareness, which includes our values, of course, our desires, our goals. We know how to say yes, and we know how to say no, and we know how to interact with others. Then, of course, there's also the aspect of self-worth. So these various aspects of self-worth and self-knowledge together work as these messages of integrity. And when we uphold and externalize these messages of integrity, there is a sense of well-being and also a healthy sense of our being. Now, ideally, a boundary is solid enough that we can protect ourselves from being pushed around by others, also from capitulating to demands of others, from absorbing other people's emotions. However, we want these boundaries to be porous enough that we don't live a life completely rigid and isolated from everyone else. So we are careful not to separate ourselves by impenetrable walls, but by boundaries that are clear and porous. So our goal is to eventually be able to encounter challenging situations and to allow them in and to be able to remain unperturbed and yet not detached. Not easy. So, for example, when we encounter somebody's anger, we are able to be present for the other person's anger, but we don't internalize it. Instead, the anger can actually just flow through us. That is, we care for the other person, but we don't get swept away in the wave of emotion. So this seems very hard. And it is. But if we think about it, we are able to do it already. Most of us, I think, we can do it sometimes with children, right? When they have a little temper tantrum and we're able to just be there, present, without getting ourselves bent out of shape. So let us look now at the idea of relativity and boundaries in relation to context and also perception. Le Guin writes that when two different roads meet at a crossing, the boundary degenerates into a line, an idea. So this suggests to me, at least, how we experience boundaries depending on the context. You know, two different roads, two different ideas, two different people. So here's a very simple example of physical boundaries and how relative they are. After living here in the States for quite a few years, I went to visit to Mexico City, and I was at the airport waiting for my suitcase, you know, standing by the carousel, and I noticed that people were getting close to me a lot. And something in me went, ooh. And then I stopped and I realized, that is very interesting. I have internalized already the American size of the invisible bubble, which here is much bigger than in other countries, as some of you will know. So that's one simple example of the most simple aspect of boundaries, which is, of course, the physical aspect. So we can say then personal boundaries are very elusive and constant flux, and yet we know they are real. We feel them when we relate to others. There's also the relativity of perception, which is colored by the individual's culture, age, education, and not to speak of mind states. So back to Le Guin, who writes, like all walls, it was ambiguous. Two-faced, what was inside it and what was outside it depended upon which side of it you were on. And so we might say that the signs that we externalized are not necessarily going to be perceived the same way we meant them to be perceived by somebody else. This is a very, very important aspect in our practice, and a very valuable one that we make as we begin to meditate more deeply and for longer periods of time. We discover how relative is our perception, and that our perception of reality is just one reality, is a reality, but it's not the reality. I also see in Le Guin's quote this aspect of maturity and perspective that comes into the boundaries. She writes, an adult could look right over it. We can imagine that a mature person is able to look over its own boundaries, values, and have some kind of perspective. Now, this is followed right away by the charming image of the child can climb over it, if you remember, climbs over the wall. And I find this image interesting for two reasons. One, if you've ever been with little kids or seen how they relate to their parents, they use their parents like climbing equipment. That's on the physical level. And on the emotional level, we all begin enmeshed with our parents, right? And it takes a long time for the child to be able to perceive that they're separate emotionally from their parents. So now I want to go to my second question. How does the concept of personal boundaries relate to the Buddhist teachings, especially of anatta, or no self? So when we go to therapy, we are hoping to gain confidence in relation to our self-understanding, our self-worth, and integrity. The sum total looks like a strong sense of self, when we make progress in our therapy. Buddhism also wants us to strengthen these qualities. However, this bundle of qualities, we don't label self. Many years ago when I started reading Dharma books, I'll confess to you, I would always stop in the place where it started to talk about no self. I just couldn't make anything out of it. And I don't think my experience is uncommon. Anatta or no self is the most difficult teaching to wrap our minds around it. Now, through the years of practice, I have come to understand that anatta is something that we have to experience directly at its own time, and that it takes a lot of years to gradually begin to have a sense a direct felt sense of what this is all about. When we try to rationalize anatta too early in our practice, what happens is that we come to often to erroneous conclusions. And this is because we don't have the direct experience that can function as a frame of reference. So it then leads to confusing assumptions of what it is to live in the world with no self. So listen to the following quote by Joy Mann. Maybe some of you have heard it already. Gill has read this quote sometimes. At a recent conference, whose theme was the psychology of awakening, Buddhism, science, and psychotherapy, many of the participants expressed their confusion regarding how the Buddha could function in the world without a self. Because they were Buddhists, they were trying to follow the teaching and to achieve or to imitate what they imagined this form of functioning could be. I thought they had missed the point. What the texts show in the character of the Buddha is someone with a very advanced self-concept. His self-esteem is perfect. He has gone beyond doubt. He knows he is confident of his knowledge, and he expresses himself with conviction. So, no self does not mean living not knowing who we are or with weak boundaries, doubtful of our abilities and aimless in our journey. The psychologist and mindfulness teacher Jack Engler expressed it succinctly. You have to have a self in order to let go of a self. That's pretty wonderful, huh? It just it couldn't be expressed more briefly and to the point. So, in other words, there's no conflict, none whatsoever, between having healthy, strong boundaries and anatta, or no self. Here's a quote by Philip Moffat. Healthy, resilient boundaries feed upon themselves the more vibrant they are, the more they develop. Paradoxically, once you become strong in your boundaries, they become more porous, and love and caring flow more easily between yourself and others. In a fully mature state, your being can seem almost transparent to others. I really love this last sentence. In a fully mature state, your being can seem almost transparent to others. So this combination of being very strong, kind, and at the same time transparent to others, I find a wonderful combination. Which, of course, is it's the unique twist that Buddhism brings, right? That transparent aspect. So we can say that cultivating strong, healthy boundaries is an act of love for ourselves and others. Because our relations with others will be more authentic and transparent when we uphold healthy boundaries and, of course, respect that of others. And now we get to the last question. How does our practice help us clarify, strengthen, and uphold our boundaries? If you've seen our last newsletter, Gil wrote an article about how we can live our sexuality according to the Eightfold Path. I thought it was a beautiful example of how we can take every aspect of our lives and fold it into the practice. So, and in particular, the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path to me suggests a guidebook. And any good guidebook is full of practical and wise advice to avoid mishaps in our journey. So in the Buddha's teachings, the Eightfold Path is such a guide for our life. And of course, the destination is liberation. We hear this term liberation a lot, and I like to challenge myself to say, yeah, but what is liberation? So I can tell you for myself, as a non-liberated being, that I cannot truly conceive what liberation really means when you're not liberated yet. And especially because it involves having let go of the ego completely. So liberation for me is one of those concepts that is better described by what it's not. Because we know what it's not. And definitely what it's not is dukkha or suffering. So liberation does not imply living with suffering. That we know and that we can comprehend. So this guide for our journey consisting of eight practices is divided into three groups: wisdom, ethics, and practice. So right view and intention that come that are the first two in the first group. They connect when we think of what makes right view and right intention. What it's saying is that we are able to live life according to the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So if we look just briefly at the Four Noble Truths applied to this topic of personal boundaries. The first Noble Truth, as many of us know already, is there is suffering. Well, there is suffering of a very specific kind when we trespass a boundary of somebody else, or when our boundaries have been trespassed, or when we are entangled in what we call enmeshment with somebody else, unable to see the psychological autonomy of the other individual. The second Noble Truth invites us to investigate, to question, to learn why is it that we suffer in relation to, in this case, personal boundaries. And the third one is where we are given the hope, right, that it is possible to end this suffering. And the fourth one points now to the path, you know, to the guide. Okay. You want to end it, then try this guide that has been tried before. And that's the Eightfold Path. So right view and right intention in general, what it is all about is, look, here is the path. Well, first you have to find it. But let's say, okay, you found it. Now be careful not to go astray and stay on it. Now, what would it be about within personal boundaries? We can say that right view, when talking about personal boundaries, would be that we practice healthy boundaries as a skillful and compassionate way of being. That we understand that anatta is not in conflict with clear and strong boundaries. that we don't confuse kindness and generosity with weak boundaries. That's an important one. That we honor psychological autonomy and avoid improper fusing of identities. And these are, especially this fusing of identities, happen a lot, unfortunately, with impersonal connection with people, personal relations. So we might, for example, want to manipulate who our grown-up son goes out with. Or we want to control what our spouse or partner looks like, how he dresses or she, or wears his hair, because his unkempt manner might reflect badly on us. Or our father writes a letter to our best friend about our personal life. Those are all examples of enmeshment. So we are aware of this. With right view, we are aware of these practices and restrain. Right intention, we hold this intention of keeping our boundaries. But at the same time, when somebody trespasses our boundaries, that we don't react impulsively when somebody trespasses our boundaries. Even if we might be feeling anger, pain, shame, we take the time to clarify how to respond to the particular situation in an honest, decisive, as well as kind manner. So in the second group that we call, that is about ethics or sila, we have right speech. And there are a couple of instances where we can trespass boundaries easily in our speech, and we usually don't see that as trespassing, or we don't recognize it as trespassing boundaries. For example, we talk badly about somebody in their absence. Even though they're not there, we are diminishing their boundaries. We are diminishing their value, excuse me, and that's why we are trespassing their boundaries. Or when we ask something from somebody and we ask it in a way that the individual cannot say no, then we're cornering that person. We're not giving them room to make up their own mind. So they're also, we are trespassing boundaries. There are four very practical, wonderful questions, brief, that we can ask ourselves when practicing wise speech. And that is, we can ask ourselves, is it timely? Is it true? Is it helpful? Is it kind? We can answer yes to all four questions. Go ahead, say what you were going to say. If we can't say yes to all four questions, take a moment, think about it. What's going on? Why do you want to say it? Right action, I would say, very important for this topic, is about the necessary preparatory clarifying investigation that needs to happen before we respond when somebody has trespassed our boundaries. There are emotions involved, and of course we want to respond in a way that can cause harm. So the more proficient we become in this investigation, the more starkly we see our shortcomings. I don't know if you've noticed that. So therefore, compassion and humor are really important to add to the mix. I was asking a dear senior Sangha member, so how do you relate to boundaries? And I loved her answer. She said, well, sometimes when I mean to say yes, I say no. And sometimes when I mean to say no, I say yes. So I thought it was a very endearing honesty in the way she answered. We don't really get it right completely in our lives. We just keep trying. Here's a quote again by Philip Moffitt. Through my own spiritual practice, I now see boundaries as being about stewardship, which means I have a responsibility for caring for my body and my mental and emotional states. If I am a good steward, opportune conditions for both psychological development and spiritual freedom will arise, and I will cause less suffering for others and myself. So I like this idea of stewardship when we're talking about action. You know, it's our responsibility. Right livelihood, it's just one question we can keep in mind. Is there any way in my livelihood, how I'm making my living, that I am in some way compromising my own well-being or integrity or that of another? And now let's go to the last group, which is the practice. And there we have right effort. It definitely takes effort in this practice to stay on the path. And within this topic, it takes a lot of effort to stick to a situation, looking at it when you're dealing with anger, and you have to stick with it and stick with it until you unravel the threads of what this is all about and what is the appropriate way to respond. So just an example of how tricky it gets. You know, when I say to get those threads apart, it's because enmeshment, really, that's what that suggests to me, these threads that have gotten all tangled up. A classic situation would be, for example, I have a brother that somehow continuously gets into financial problems. I help out. Next time, again, he's in trouble. And this repeats over and over again. Now, in enmeshment, I cannot conceive any other way of responding to his situation. So I just keep repeating, and we're both entangled in this dance. So here we have to really make an effort to stop and say, wait a minute, there is something that's not working. Can I look at this in another way? Can I stop and speak wisely, use right speech, and allow my brother the opportunity to take responsibility of his own life? Maybe he will. Maybe he won't, but at least we will give that opportunity and we will speak from that place of clarity and strength. Now, this speaking up, for some of you who were brought up to be very polite, like in my family, especially the females, we are supposed to be so nice and so accommodating and polite, that it's extraordinarily difficult to speak strongly and say, no, this is not acceptable. It really brings up a lot of fear. But it's also about practice, so and effort. So we make effort, and it does start, I can tell you from my own experience, it does start get a little bit easier with time if you keep calmly, strongly, and kindly speaking up. Here's another quote by Philip Moffitt that I think is wonderful. If you can't maintain your boundary, you acquiesce and are pulled into someone else's drama. It's great, isn't it? It's just exactly what happens. Now, mindfulness is a wonderful practice for the topic of boundaries. Because what we're doing with mindfulness is bringing attention of what's happening in the present, what's happening with my body, what's happening with my thoughts, with my emotions. But especially the bringing the attention to the body is crucial here. Why? Because when your boundaries are trespassed, the very first alert signs you will have will be your body. Your body will tense up. First your body, then your mind kind of comes limping along. But first the body. So if we already have that discipline of paying attention to our body, then we have very good chance that we will catch this happening early on. And the last practice, right concentration. Concentration is all about unifying the mind, right? You unify the mind. When you unify the mind, then you get equanimity. When you get equanimity, then there's a sense of well-being, clarity, energy. And now, from those wonderful states, you have a very, very likely chance to act in a resolute, clear, and kind manner. So I hope that you see how using the Eightfold Path as a guide, we can really work with our very difficult topic of personal boundaries in a very skillful way. I want to finish with a poem by Sarah Holbrook. Walking on the boundaries of change day by day, a tightrope. Walking on the boundaries of change, one step, firm, familiar. The next step, shaky, strange. Some friends will dare danger, mock or push each step. Some friends knock your confidence. Real friends form a net. Thank you. So let's take 1 minute and have some quiet, and maybe we can think if there's a comment, something that we'd like to discuss a little further, a question. So we have about 4 minutes, and in this 4 minutes, if there is a question, comment, yes, please, let's get the mic.
Thank you for that talk. It's on already? Oh, good. Okay. In business, as well as most things in life, your boundaries are very important. It's very surprising to me that this talk was even given, though, in a Buddhist group, you know, because it's clear this is not something, it's an evolving thing that mm-hmm. one needs to, and certainly in my life. I would just say, you know, like, I'm still having this issue in my elder years, and I would just say something like, I could give examples, but I would say for most young people, it's really important to start, you know, valuing yourself and enough to, you know, to be forthright in your own heart and desires, and not that you, that necessarily equates to being selfish, but You know, that's something one needs to be very careful about. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, please. Right here.
I just wanted to ask about, do you have to be clear about responsibility to be clear about boundaries?
Responsibility, of course, is a very, very important aspect with boundaries, right? And that's where clarity comes in, that we need to take the time to clarify ourselves what is our responsibility. For example, we could have a situation at work that a coworker asks you the favor to help him out, but in reality, he's asking you to do his job. And so you need to take your time to clarify, what is my responsibility? What is his responsibility? What are my priorities? My priority is to get my work done. You know, and so then really act according to it, and be careful that we don't that you don't fall into the guilt thing. Is like, I should be always willing to help, which, you know, especially if you have a spiritual practice, you think that you are always supposed to be available and ready to help.
Especially for family.
Yes, exactly. You know, that's why it's particularly tricky with interpersonal relations, this topic. Yeah, but it's possible. So it's actually 9:00, so thank you very much.